Oi, oi, it's your boy, the Petch Morricot of saying, show me what you got. Jack Slack, and it's the Jack Slack podcast, boycast, whatever it is, it's for the boys. Everything I do it for the boys. But I just got done watching one championship, their event in Singapore. They booked out a stadium, and apparently it's now legal to have stadium events there. Because they had very strict COVID rules before that, but now it is legal, and they still did it with no one there. Like, just crazy. But this is the thing, we're gonna be talking about one, so I'm going to preface this with yes, I had a wonderful time watching this, but also, one is just such a fucking shady mess of a company. I love it. I mean, I love that they are embezzling millions, well, hundreds of millions at this point, of dollars of venture capitalist fail-son money and paying fighters a lot better than a lot of places do and handing out 50k bonuses every which way if you do something interesting. I mean, they do it for clout online so that they can show the impoverished jiu-jitsu man freak out when he's given 50 grand on the microphone in the post-fight interview. But I do love it. It's fantastic. And what I really love, because I was also having this discussion this week about what is the actual number two MMA promotion in the world, because I don't think it's Bellator. I don't think it's been Bellator for a while. But when I say one isn't really an MMA promotion. They're a company that does some MMA fights, but the MMA fights on this card, there were like two. There was a women's MMA fight and then a fight between two, like, dudes from not even like the Asian scene, just random dudes from Asia with losing records. But what I love about one is that they really delve in. They do all the rule sets, which is a setup to fuck things up in one sense. Like Petch Morricot, who fought in the final fight on this card, famously beat Giorgio Petrosian in their kickboxing tournament by kneeing him in the clinch or whatever, and that was then overturned because they didn't like it. They wanted Giorgio Petrosian to win. But then, you know, Stamp Fairtex had thrown the Taiwanese lass she fought in her kickboxing title bout, and they didn't give a shit about that. But in mixing the rule sets and using the same refs and having, like, kickboxing and Muay Thai on the same card, sometimes in 4-ounce gloves, the Muay Thai, sometimes they used to do it in the full gloves too. So it was really confusing, and you do set yourself up for some disastrous calls or just misinterpretation of the rules, just people forgetting where they are. But to me, it reminds me a lot of in Enter the Dragon, which most of my life is built around. Most of my life is built around seeing Enter the Dragon when I was a child, and then everything I relate to, I'm like, oh, just like in Enter the Dragon. But in Enter the Dragon, they turn up at Hans Island to go into the tournament and fight for the title or whatever it is. And that's how they infiltrate the island, by invitation. But when they get there, there's that big festival going on. There's a sumo match happening. There's all sorts of other stuff going on. There's guys in karate gis training out in the courtyard. And that's what one feels like. It feels like a rich dude's island doing a full every kind of fighting thing. We're only missing like a staged Hickson and Hoyler going through the motions in a jiu-jitsu demonstration at like Pride 3 or whatever it was. But yeah, I'm highly recommending watching this, because I was holding off on doing this boycast because the UFC this weekend is so fucking bad. They've got Holly Holm coming back from a year off or 2 years off or whatever it is, and nothing else. So I was going, what the fuck am I going to talk about? Then I realized this card was happening today. So I held off, watched it live, which was in one sense exhilarating and exciting, and I got to have a cup of tea, I got to eat a slice of Victoria sponge, got to have another cup of tea, but I did also have to sit through all of the bollocks, which is just unending with one. I described it as having a nice 7-course meal, but they make you wait 15 minutes between courses, and when they clear the table, they pitch you on a timeshare. So it's just constant, like, montages of one bollocks. I do like that they show like their fastest knockouts or whatever to fill time. But then they got Mitch Chilson and Mike Chiavello up there just vamping for 15 minutes at a time to the camera. You know when they do that bit at the start of the UFC events where they have the three commentators talking to the camera, and it goes on for about 5 minutes. But there's got to be about 45 minutes of that on this card. So if I get moany about this shit, don't think that I didn't love the fights, because I did love the fights, and we're going to talk about the fights very positively, but I am also going to moan about some of the shit that happened in between. And some of the shit that happened by the judges and refs in the fights. So what should we go with first? Let's talk about the main event, because I'm still hot from that. Petr Morakot versus Jimmy Vino. I don't know a lot about Jimmy Vino. My boy Sean Madden from Elevation said put some respect on his name. I presume he's very good. I saw him in this fight. He was very good. But it was really interesting because Petr Morakot has always been the tall guy, and this guy, Jimmy Vino, towered over him. And it really threw Petr Morakot for the first round or two. Like, the first time that Jimmy Vino threw a... They're both southpaw, so a 1-2. Petr Morakot went to lean back and just got dinged on the end of the two. And it was like, uh-oh, I'm not taller and longer than my opponent this time. But Jimmy Vino just lit Petr Morakot up with low kicks. He's got beautiful snap... I'm starting to call them snap low kicks because I saw Jeff Chan. I was watching his instructional on Fanatics the other day, which was actually really good. But he differentiates between a snap low kick and a power low kick in that it depends on how much pivot you put into your kick. And of course, if you watch really good low kickers, especially counter low kickers, I'm not talking Ramon Dekkers, you know, Rob Kamen, you know, punch, 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 step, pivot, swing everything through and hack in with the low kick. That would be a power low kick. That would be a very extreme power low kick. But Jimmy Vino and others like him are very good at almost you just point your foot at an angle to begin with and go up on the ball of the foot as you kick, and you don't really pivot much. And those are the ones you'll catch guys with on one leg or coming down, and they're very important, particularly in Muay Thai, because so much of the game is absorbing a kick on your arms or your check and immediately trying to get back in on either the standing leg or second-guessing them and getting the leg that's coming down as they stand on that leg to try and check with the other leg. So he was beautiful. It reminded me a lot of, in MMA, Tarek Safadine, who you won't hear a lot about, but for a little while he was actually really impressive. But he used to do a great job of just sort of standing in his stance, double forearms guard, really high up. The guy would throw like a jab at him or a 1-2 or a 1-2-3 or whatever. He'd take it on his guard and he'd immediately kick back. Almost no rotation on his lead leg. Just bang in the leg. Same spot every time. And he just murdered people. Well, he murdered Nate Marquardt with it. I think that was the last Strikeforce card, wasn't it? But obviously Jimmy Vino doing it at a much higher level against much better kickboxers. And then the other thing was that, like, Petr Morakot, obviously, not only normally taller and longer than his opponents, so they're punching up at him and he's able to lean back and get out of the way of stuff, but also southpaw, so he's often fighting orthodox fighters. And it looked like his brain was malfunctioning this one, because as a trend amongst good Thai Nak Muay, you will notice that they tend to kick into the open side. So if you're orthodox and the opponent's orthodox, you do a lot of switch kicks, you do a lot of step-up left kicks, you don't throw the right kick as much to the above the waist. Whereas if you're a southpaw fighter, sorry, if you're an orthodox fighter in southpaw, you're both hammering in your rear leg to the open side of the opponent's body. Petr Morakot is used to doing that against orthodox opponents. Against Jimmy Vino, he kept throwing the left round kick to the body, which is probably the least damaging thing you can do with that shot. Now, I'm not saying that kicks into the close side don't hurt. I mean, an MMA example would be like Jan Blachowicz versus Dominic Reyes. He stepped up, hit him with a stepping round kick to the backside of his body and left a huge dent in it. But, I mean, the guy did take it, circle off, and was fine. It was just a big bruise. The reason you don't tend to do it as much is because the way to catch that is much easier. If you're catching kicks on the open side, you have to scoop across, you have to parry across, you have to do something with the hand that's not absorbing the blow or that's not on the side absorbing the blow. If you take a kick to your backside, your closed side, you really just take it on your back and wrap your arm over it. You know, watch Paulo Costa versus Israel Adesanya is a great example. And Petr Morakot kept stepping in and throwing a left kick to the backside of Vino's body, and Vino would catch it, step in and dump him. Like, he'd sweep the leg out and throw him across the, he was in a cage, which we'll moan more about later. But Petr Morakot would smile, stand up, give it the bravado, which is, you know, standard in Muay Thai, but he kept doing it, and his corner were asking him not to do it. So he was clearly having a bit of a brain malfunction because he was going to something that he does a lot and just not, you know, part of fighting a different style or stance matchup is learning to not do things that you would normally do. That's probably harder than training people to do new things. Trying to teach them not to do the things that they always do and have great success with. We were talking about Charles Oliveira's left hook the other day. He had to be real careful with that because getting into left hooking with another great left hooker, very dangerous. Against Justin Gaethje, that is. So, yeah, this for about a round, no, two rounds, Jimmy Vino beat him up. And then Petr Morakot, if you know what he's good at, he's very good at hitting people with both step knees and knees from the clinch. And Jimmy Vino came into the clinch but left a bit too much room. He'd been tying up really well up to that point. And Petr Morakot hit him with, I think, about two knees. He hit him with one knee, and then like the next clinch, he hit him with another knee. And Vino's whole complexion changed. The fight changed completely. He was suddenly on the back foot. He was sort of trying to get away from Petr Morakot. And then he got stuck in this area where Petr Morakot was throwing combinations at him, and he'd try and duck inside to the clinch. But then he was like, I don't want to be in the clinch. So there's a couple of moments where he comes in to close, and then he almost backs out again after as he does it. So he ended up sort of confusing himself, having got hurt by that those couple of knees. And that third round was a bit disastrous for him. Start of the fourth round was also bad for him. But he started every single round coming out to the centre. Petr Morakot immediately threw the left round kick to his body, and Jimmy Vino would dump him again. You're going, how many times are you going to let him do that to you? You know? And obviously in Thailand, that's a big deal. That scores well. In one, nobody knows what scores, which is how this fight ended, because Vino got back into it in the fifth. But this fight ended with most people thinking that Jimmy Vino probably won. But we don't know how we're supposed to score it, because one has never said how they score it. They've been quite, like, the way that they present it is, yeah, but we definitely don't use the 10-point must system. You know, that's the only reason they wouldn't tell you what their scoring system is or make a big deal out of it, is because they're not using the 10-point must system. So the knockdown that, oh, sorry, I forgot to say, Petr Morakot did knock him down with a really good right hand after slowing him down with those knees. But if you're not saying, if you're making a point of using a different scoring system to the 10-point must system, we don't have to give a 10-8 for that round. So, you know, I don't even know what to make of this. You know, it's just one being shady. And then after every decision, if you feel like it's going to be close, I mean, it might just be because people pay attention when it's close, but you know that they're fucking around, because you can hear, like, Michael Schiavello has to vamp for them, because there can't be a minute of dead air on the broadcast, which is exhausting to listen to. But he'll be like, oh, they're tabulating the scorecards, and he's like making a joke of it. But also, why is it taking so long to bring in three scores that aren't, I mean, we don't know how they're done. They might be literally strikes I saw land, and you score them. like amateur boxing had that electronic system for a while. But it came in split decision for Petr Morakot, and, you know, everyone goes, that's bullshit, but why not just tell us how you score the fucking fights, so that we can be at home and go, oh, actually, no, when you're talking about it that way, I can see how Petr Morakot won. So super impressed with Vino. Sort of impressed by Petr Morakot being so dangerous in the middle going. I don't really know him as like a great hurter. I know him as a sort of a grindy guy. And it was really interesting to see how quickly he could change the whole fight with a couple of well-placed knees. And Jimmy Vino, I don't know at all, so now I do. In fact, that's going to be a theme on this card. I haven't seen a lot of these fighters, and I was very impressed by a lot of them. So, yeah, just in case you're wondering if I'm being like, as a Muay Thai authority, I am not a Muay Thai authority at all. One of the great things about ONE Championship is that they've tricked people into watching it thinking it's an MMA organization, and they presented them with 4 hours Muay Thai, which is fantastic. They've given Muay Thai fighters a chance to earn a ton of money and actually get some popularity. You know, every day ONE puts up a new Rod Tang spam video to their YouTube, and they've made him into a star. Which is good. I mean, a Rod Tang should be a star, but also it's very funny that they literally upload a Rod Tang clip every day. But it also means that I don't have to go and watch, like, the random YouTube channels that you used to have to go and find. I mean, I didn't watch, like, the whole night at the stadium or whatever, but I used to have to go and find, like, Muang Thai's fights, because I love him. And just trawling through these accounts with hundreds of videos that aren't edited, they're just uploaded, they're clipped out of the night of fights, and they're uploaded, and there's the fucking doodly flute going in the background, which I fucking hate.
Bruh.
And now I can see it whenever I, you know, whenever there's a one card on, I go, oh, damn, so-and-so's fighting. Or, oh, damn, I've never seen him before. He's fantastic. So another great thing about One, to be honest. This is just going to be a podcast of great and awful things about One. Co-main event was Prajin Chai, which I'm probably not saying right. All Thai names I will be saying wrong. But Thai is one of the weirdest and most complicated languages I've ever seen. Because I can't even... If I see it written down, the words are not the same as what the person's saying. Like Pech Morakot, his actual name is like Fot Murama or something like that, if it's written out in Times New Roman. Romanicized, sorry. So I've no idea. But Prajin Chai is a guy from Sanchai's gym. Joseph Laziri apparently started his run in One with four losses back-to-back. But Laziri blew my fucking socks off in this fight. Just came out, circled to his right constantly. They're both orthodox. Prajin Chai kept doing he had the Sanchai flappy hands down, because Sanchai doesn't really punch a lot. But what he'll do is, like, flap his hands at the opponent and really agitate them back towards the ropes, he doesn't fight in the cage, but to the ropes, and Prajin Chai did it here to the fence. So he's, like, flapping his hands and throwing, like, slappy left hooks to line up a right hand. Cracks Laziri a couple of times with that early. But Laziri was doing a really nice, measured job early on. Inside low kicks. Something I'm gonna talk about generally. With this card and watching high-level Muay Thai is I've said it earlier when I was saying Tariq Saifuddin hits the same spot over and over again with his low kick. Not necessarily important in Muay Thai. You know, if you hit the same spot over and over again, that's going to really hurt someone much quicker. You're going to build up swelling and so on. But one of the things you'll notice in really good high-level Muay Thai fights is that guys will change the angles on their kicks and teeps and things a lot. And a lot of that is to do with breaking the opponent's balance and breaking their pressure. So just the other month, there was a fight between Murat Gregorian and Superbon. And Murat Gregorian had a good little run. Well, I mean, he was one of the best guys in the world. He still is. But he had a really good little run. And one of the guys that he smoked was Superbon, who was already very good. I think he was a stadium champion somewhere. But, Thailand, presumably. Give myself a bra for that. But Murat Gregorian very quickly pressured him down and hit him with the right hand as Superbon was trying to fight sort of backing up. When you watched the rematch the other month, one of the things, there was a great tweet someone put out with it was like 15 seconds of Superbon using anti-pressure strategies. And it was him, he's got his feet under him. He's just sort of slowly or gently bouncing from one foot to the other. And he's sliding back each time, very small steps. And he's picking his lead leg up to teep the body. He's picking his right leg up and putting not like a power oblique kick, but just jamming in above the knee. He's doing it below the knee. He's framing on Gregorian with his left hand and showing that. The one I'm just talking about with Laziri, the very, very low left kick. So it is basically a foot sweep. You go in with basically the top of your ankle, bottom of your shin, inside their lead leg. And if you watched Wakao versus Zambidis back in the day, guys who throw themselves forward into overhands, you can just take that leg out. Or you can make them stand back and not throw their weight forward by just hacking at it or tapping at it. And there's a great little combination where you do that, you tap the, or you... You kick the inside of the lead leg very low while framing on them with your left hand, and then you come up with the right uppercut because their balance gets broken forwards. And on this card, there was another one. It was Superlek. He was fighting Naito. And as Naito was stepping in to swing on him, he picked up his left foot, his lead foot, and he just put like the sole of his foot on the inside of Naito's lead leg as Naito stepped in to swing, because, you know, if guys step in to swing the overhand, they tend to put their lead foot out to the left a bit as they step in to do it. And he lined it up so that his lead foot was push-kicking, but inside the knee outwards. And then there's the one that Rico Verhoeven's always doing, which is like the little oblique kick just above the left hip of the opponent. You know, these little balance-breaking techniques. And if you catch a guy when he's kicking, he'll fall over. If you catch a guy while he's opening up to punch, you'll break his balance and break his attack and stop him attacking in combination. You know, these kicks, especially like the teeps to the thigh, In MMA, we're used to guys just stomping on the knee and trying to invert it, basically. But in Muay Thai, you'll see it all the time. Super Bond did it to Murat Gregorian. There was a load of them on this card. But guys will just do it to, when you straighten the guy's leg out, you don't need to put a ton of force into it. You just push it and his hips will go back and his head will come forwards. And it's very hard to keep moving in combination and working effectively. You know, just like, it's kind of like when you, in boxing, you grab the back of the head and you pull it forward. You know, Joe Frazier versus Muhammad Ali, keep pulling the head down. Very, very hard to keep combination punching effectively when your posture's all fucked up. So there was tons of that on this card. And that was really one of the things that, if I was telling someone, someone coming over from MMA to watch 4 ounce Muay Thai, that's one of the things they'd be probably surprised by. And maybe not even notice. They'd just, I think you probably notice that people aren't just swinging for the fences all the time. But those little in-between strikes, not only to set things up, but also to break the opponent's balance and then allow you to come back in on them. You know, making people feel like they don't want to open up is a really big part of it. So all that, that was just a tangent, but it was all stuff I wanted to talk about. But Lasiri came out inside, very low kick, like down by the ankle. And then he'd do that and fake it and go into a jab. And I really liked that. He could just sort of glide in with that. Prajnchai hit him with a right hand at one point, and he looked hurt, and he immediately came back with a combination of like jab, lead, uppercut, left hook to the body, right knee. And in the course of that, he tore Prajnchai's eye open. Can't remember. I think it was a cut above the eye. And it all just went downhill for there from Prajnchai. Because once the eye was cut, Lasiri just went after him. And then he came out of the next round, did the thing where he circled around again and Prajnchai almost hit him. And then he got hit, and then he went ham, beating Prajnchai up. Very nice jabs into left-handed combinations. Prince Nazim used to be good at this, actually, when he bothered the combination punch. The jab into the left uppercut. Really loved that. He was southpaw, so southpaw jab into right uppercut. Lead hand uppercuts, they're banging. But Prajnchai actually quit on the stool between the third and fourth round. It was very impressive that Lasiri could do that. And clearly, like, he was underdog, but he was also clearly not supposed to do this because I don't think he's a star for them. But, you know, he might be after this. I mean, everything I heard about, like, his run before this sounds like he wasn't that great. And this performance, really, I was on the edge of my seat going, damn, this lad is fantastic. Now, we'll see if it's a flash in the pan, if you can follow up. There are people, you know, the old Cody Garbrandt syndrome. There are people who just have a great night. And it's not, you don't have to discredit the opponent and say like, oh, you know, Prajnchai had food poisoning that night or whatever. You can just say, damn, Lasiri was on that night. Shame he never achieved that again. It does happen. You know, Buster Douglas fought the fight of his life. You can make all the excuses about Tyson you want, but he looked better that night himself. If you took Tyson off every screen, you know, off every frame of that fight, Douglas still looked better than he'd ever looked before. Those were the two title fights, and then there was this tournament, which was great fun. The alternates were great. That was Sherzod Khabibov, who they kept calling Sherzod, which was very confusing, versus Denis Puric, and Khabibov, along with Lasiri, just showed one of the things that I love about 4 ounce Muay Thai. A lot easier to sneak through a jab. It's a lot easier to palm a jab or just knock it offline if you've got bigger gloves. I don't know how the power is affected. I don't know if the cuts are more likely with the 4 ounce gloves, but I do know that it's a lot easier to parry with a big glove against a big glove than it is to parry with a smaller glove against a smaller glove. So the jab really does make a difference in these fights. And Khabibov was doing a great job of... there was a guy called Phil Norman who had this system called Ghost, and I really need to look it up and buy whatever he put out, but he was very big about going around the ring backwards and trying to get people to walk onto things, which I've always been very big on. But Khabibov was doing a great job of like poking Puric just enough to get him coming at him, and then he'd circle around the ring and blast him with jabs and hurt him stepping onto things. But then every time Khabibov went to him, Puric would hit him with a counter right hand and hurt him. So he kept doing this. He kept going to Puric with a back kick, which is just don't advance with back kicks generally, unless you're doing like the Kung Lee full step through and you can get them to the ropes or the fence. It's just not worth it. Back kicks are best when you do either like the little hopping one, the Raymond Daniels, Anthony Pettis style, where you know you catch them coming in, you intercept them with a counter, so you hop in the air so that you can turn quicker. Not as powerful, but a great way to land it. Or you get them to the fence and or the ropes, rather, and as they circle to your lead side, you spin into the back kick. Those are the times you're going to catch someone. Go into people with back kicks. Very tricky. Very dangerous. There's a lot of... you are going forwards towards them without them being committed to attacking you, and they can see you going towards them. And if they move in one of any direction except into the back kick, you're going to end up looking like a tit. And Kabatov got hit with about three great right hands off three missed back kicks going towards the guy. But I was really impressed with him. I thought he was really good otherwise. And then, so that was the alternate bout. Savas Michael versus Amir Nasseri. Apparently Nasseri won a stadium title in Thailand. I haven't looked into that, but apparently he did. They kept saying it. But with one, you know, they claim that everyone on the roster is a world champion of something. So you never know. But Savas Michael, man, he just couldn't miss. He was in the zone. From the very get-go, I was reminded of something that Freddie Roach said about sparring with Alexis Arguello when he was coming up. And he said, Alexis Arguello knew what you would do to avoid or counter something, and then he would hit you with the thing that you didn't expect. And that's not like being unpredictable in terms of like, oh, don't I do weird shit? That's knowing exactly what you're supposed to do there and doing something different and catching them instead because you know that they know what you're going to be doing. Very impressive. And that's what Savas Michael just oozed in this fight. The first round, I would say, the whole fight is great, but in the late second and third, Savas Michael's just sort of like hitting him with 1-2s and Nasiri's just sort of trying to plow through. But the first round, when Nasiri's trying to throw sort of a little bit of everything and he's being technical and he's trying to show different looks, Michael, just everything that comes at him, he absorbs it or evades it and immediately hits Nasiri on his standing leg. Or as his kicking leg comes down, he'll hit that. Or he'll slide down the side of him and hit him with the left hook. Like, it was just so many different counters that were the right thing to do against that specific technique at that time. The man was on that drug from that crap Bradley Cooper movie. He just saw it all. He saw the Matrix. It was fantastic. So he's my boy now. Big fan of Savas Michael. He's got Rod Tang in the next round. So that's a great fight because it's one thing to be able to pick off a guy who's just sort of like going, oh, I'm going to have a go at him now, and then taking a break and going, oh, now's the time to have a go at him again, as opposed to a guy who's just going to walk you down constantly. Superlek fought Taiki Naito and beat him up. I mean, Superlek's kicks are incredible. I mean, he's known for his kicks, but like every time I see him, I cannot get over just how nasty the kicks sound. And there was one in this fight where Taiki Naito missed a kick and Superlek like retracted his lead leg, then put it back and threw his rear leg just as Taiki Naito was facing into the kick, and Taiki Naito took it on the cup. I was like, yeah, no shame crying, mate, because I would cry if Superlek kicked me in the cup. but the real surprise in this one was Superlek using his elbows. He just went after Naito, cut him up. Those vertical Muang Thai style elbows right up through the middle of the guard, which my boy, Linton Vassell. Milton Keynes from Linton Vassell. He's great at dropping those from the top of mount, just straight up the middle. So Superlek got a pretty uncontested decision. I mean, Naito was tough, liked what he was trying to do, but just didn't have the answers, was slower mechanically and didn't have like an idea of how to change that fight. And then the last fight of the tournament that night was Rod Tang versus Jacob Smith. Man, Jacob Smith really... I admire him, very tough guy, really liked some of the stuff he was trying to do, but Rod Tang is another case of the Diaz thing. It's another case of basically anyone who's got an amazing chin. All these guys come in and go, yeah, but he's never been hit by me. And that's such a terrible game plan or attitude to have. The thing about Rod Tang is that with him always coming at you, yeah, he's always there to hit. And guys do hit him in the chin over and over again, and it doesn't hurt him. So why would you bank on being the first person? Well, no, the second person, because he was knocked out once when he was like 16. But why would you bank on being the first person in 100 fights to hit him hard enough to knock him out? Someone will. It's like I said about the Diazes. Someone will hit them hard enough or catch them just at a weird time, and they'll get knocked out. That's just the way it works. But why would you build your whole game on being that when so many, you know, the fact, it's not that his head is a floating thing on its own, and that's the most hittable thing. It's that he's hittable because he's there all the time. He's coming at you. He's not running from you. So the legs and body are there. But the thing about good pressure fighting is that it convinces people that they need more and more to bank on the one shot. So, you know, once you get into like the second and third round, especially if a guy's been hurt, and you're going, please go to the body, please go to the legs, please throw some fucking elbows, stop trying to punch him in the head. The chances are less and less that they'll do that because they're getting fixated on getting the finish and getting, you know, getting the Hail Mary, basically. But with someone like Rod Tang, it's got to be, like, when you're punching, it's the jab, because that's the weapon that keeps him at range, that's the weapon that can cut his eyes up, close his eyes, and hide other weapons. If you're trying to hurt him to the head, it's got to be the elbows, because you will cut him. And also, you don't have a big piece of padding over your fist. And cutting people who are pressure fighters, cutting them should be a huge priority. And then it's got to be the body, because that's going to slow him down. It's got to be the legs, because that's going to slow him down. If you can get him checking kicks, at least he's standing on one leg for a moment, so you can fucking run out the side door. Jacob Smith and others I've seen fight Rod Tang in a way that is not conducive to winning. It's been like, I am going to throw hard combinations of punches. And I think that's partly to do with sort of the European attitude to Muay Thai and kickboxing. You know, it's like the Dutch kickboxing thing, but you guys almost absorb this like, well, I'm going to punch harder. You know, they don't score that as well in the stadiums, but I'm going to throw lovely combinations of punches and low kicks. And I think a lot of people fall into that because it's like, you know, if guys have been clinch fighting since they were children, it's very hard to beat them in the clinch with knees and things and sweeps. But, you know, John Haggerty had to drop out of this, which was really unfortunate. But one of the things that he did amazingly, just generally, one of the reasons that he's been able to surprise a lot of really good Thai fighters is that he invested in learning to teep and lead leg kick and knock people off balance and fake with his, like, by pumping his lead leg and use elbows. And his boxing is really an afterthought. And his boxing is something that sort of lets him down. I thought it let him down in the first fight against Rod Tang, not being able to use his footwork and get away, not being able to tie up very well. The second fight was much more Rod Tang adapting to his excellent teep and using it to get inside and hit the body really well. But if you watch how much trouble Rod Tang had getting past his lead leg in that first fight, and then you consider just how many people have thrown teeps at Rod Tang in his career, you know, it's very impressive that Haggerty was able to bring his teep up to that level. But I think a lot of people in Western kickboxing and Western Muay Thai sort of bank on being better in the punches because it's not as highly valued in Thailand, but you know, plenty of these Thai gyms have produced guys who've then switched to boxing for money and won world titles. I'm going full circle. I'm going in circles here, but just like, there's never a way that you can try and punch with Rod Tang and I'll think it's a good idea, unless you're hitting the body a lot, but there are better weapons available to you. And this is the thing, like, yes, the range on a punch and a elbow is slightly different, but every time he punched, he was in range for Rod Tang to do a little slide in an elbow. And that's what kept happening. So you might as well just try and elbow him, because you get elbowed anyway. And his corner were calling for this. This isn't just me being like, oh, what a crap game plan, because literally his corner were asking him to do this. But he'd been roughed up by the end of the first round, you know, by wasting time trying to spam hands at him. There was a really nice little movie he did in the first round, which reminded me of something Buakaw used to do, which is hip feint the rear kick. So you slide up a little bit. And then Buakaw would throw a left hook to the body instead. Great way to lead with a left hook to the body. But here he threw like a left up jab and snapped Rod Tang's head back. But man, Rod Tang looked monster in this one. I'm really excited for the idea of him versus Savas. Oh, and Walter Goncalves. Sorry, I almost forgot him. You know, this is really funny because it used to be that they were selling like the Goncalves-Rod Tang fight as like, well, Goncalves only survived because he ran from him. And that was one of the interesting things coming into this tournament. They've decided to do it all, in spite of only having two MMA fights on the card and them really being the afterthought, they decided to do it all in the cage, which Walter Goncalves got around Rod Tang and was able to sort of poke and run because Rod Tang couldn't cut the cage on him at all. Like, you know, you watch Rod Tang corner Haggerty in the ring when he has him hurt, and you're going, damn, that's some inscrutable pressure. But you put that in the cage, he's having real trouble. I mean, he did corner DJ, so I'm not saying there's no skill to it. But yeah, Walter Goncalves, it's very interesting because they've switched the narrative from, oh, he only survived because he ran, to this is the man who gave Rod Tang his hardest fight. And I watched them do this in the week they were doing things on YouTube. Just like, Walter Goncalves, Rotang's hardest opponent so far. But he fought Jesu Cruz. I was excited to see what Cruz had because I've never seen him before. He's Mexican, which I thought was an interesting place to come from if you're in Muay Thai. But didn't get going. Walter Goncalves did not expect him to come out like a fucking buzzsaw. But he came out and it was kind of like when you watch a fight between two dudes on WorldStar. And they're, you know, two dudes in the hood always. But they're going at each other like sort of hip in first, leaning back at the waist. And then they'll go to swing and then they'll reconsider it and pull their head back immediately. You know, that's sort of like, and that's what Goncalves was doing. He kept like coming in and then pulling his head back and then coming in and then pulling his head back. And it really threw Cruz off. He sort of panicked and went to the fence. And then Goncalves goes 1-2, left hook to the body. But he got really low and Cruz is also tall. So rather than like elbow tight, hand pointing upwards or fingers pointing upwards, palm pointing upwards, shovel hooky sort of thing to the body. He's doing like an open elbow, full left hook, palm pointing down, left hook to the body. And he lands it and Cruz just folds in half, but against the fence. And of course, the rule in Muay Thai that they always try and exploit is if the guy's not completely down, you can hit him again. They're always trying to like hit a trip and kick you in the head as you're going down. I've seen a couple of ones that actually worked. It's very rare for it to work because you've got such a small window. But I've seen a couple that work and it's absolutely brutal. But Goncalves, like, he's just folding slowly along the fence and he hits him with two knees in the head on the way down. So I think if Cruz had just gone to, like, his knee out in the open, or been able to, rather, he got sort of stuck against the fence. But if he'd been able to do that, I think he probably would have had a chance at recovering. But you take two knees to the head while you're crunching over and you know, if you've been hit in the body, in the liver, really well, you almost are like, oh, I don't care that you're punching me in the head. You're like, oh, I'm in so much pain. But yeah, great finish from Walter Goncalves. Fantastic work. So that sets up Goncalves versus Superlek in the next round and Rod Tang versus Michael. What else was on here? Oh my God, they had Wonder Girl Fairtex, who I don't know if she's a big deal, but they're trying to make her a big deal, making her MMA debut. Whenever they do this, like they did with Sam Fairtex, they find an undefeated Indian girl, and then you look at the undefeated Indian girl's record, and they're saying she's got 6 fights. 5 of them are like random exhibitions against people who've never fought. The one professional fight was against a lass who was 0-5, and it still went to split decision. So they go like, undefeated Indian juggernaut, she's coming for the title, and then this girl pushes Wonder Girl Fairtex to the fence with underhooks, and then she takes the underhooks out and tries to grab her around the head. So she had her, and then she was like, I want to do a headlock throw. And Wonder Girl gets out and hits her, and then she somehow managed to get armbarred by Wonder Girl, which is just shows you the level of this fight. David Kiria versus Mohamed Boutassa. I thought Boutassa was really impressive. David Kiria always fighting at height disadvantage, but Boutassa very tall and kept throwing step knees to the head, which is brutal. But it was sort of a case of Boutassa, yeah, he impressed me. But David Kiria, you know, if you watched his whole glory run, there are fights where he just doesn't have any ideas. And in this one, he didn't even throw his, like, contractually obliged rolling thunder. He just didn't have anything. There was a really nice, he got a clinch and hit a left hook as the ref was telling him to break, but it didn't have an idea what he wanted to do. I know he's from like his own gym called like David Kiria gym, so I don't know if he's got like a serious team in his corner, but they didn't tell him to do anything different. And then there was the grappling matches. You had first Shinny Aoki versus Cade Ruotolo. Shinny Aoki, you know, he's an interesting guy because he hasn't actually achieved much in grappling, but they keep marketing him as like the greatest grappler who's ever lived. You know, they were trying to do Gordon Ryan versus Shinny Aoki, and you're just going, why? That's a waste of everyone's time. But Shinny Aoki is, he did qualify for the ADCC by running through the Japanese trials in 2005, just murdering dudes. And there were Brazilian dudes over there. You know, when you see like European trials and you go, ah, that must be easier. There are Brazilians being shipped over to those trials to try and win there. It's like the South American trials and the North American trials had the same amount of Brazilians in, but Shinny Aoki just ran through those, and in 2005 he goes to ADCC, and he didn't win a single match, because in his division, his first match was against Marcelo Garcia, who was on his, like, 4 ADCC undefeated run. And then in the absolute division, he met Roger Gracie, who's not only 6'4" and 250 pounds, but also one of the best grapplers ever, and again went on to win the absolute that year. So he fought the two winners of the divisions in the first match. So you didn't really get a sense of how good he was in the field. But since then, you know, he's been an MMA fighter. He's just, because he's such a one-dimensional MMA fighter, people think that he must be an elite grappler as well, but it's really about applying it to MMA. Cade Ruotolo did what Cade Ruotolo and Tai Ruotolo do. The Atos guys, so him, sorry, those two, Kanan, Andre Galvao, in any no-gi match, they are obsessed with grabbing the head, not just one collar tie, but two. You don't see the double collar tie a lot in wrestling, but these guys go for it all the time because they like to pull the head down and try and, you know, if you can pull someone's head down, you can snap them down and grab a front headlock. You saw Tai Ruotolo was able to do it against Gary Turner, very good wrestler in jiu-jitsu terms, in grappling terms, but Tai Ruotolo had him bending over at the waist and almost like not able to see what he was supposed to be doing. And both of them do this constant like stamping on the floor and leg fainting. They look like spazzes on the feet. They look like they're going to knee you or slap you in the head. But Shinya Aoki versus Cade Ruotolo. Shinya Aoki's plan in this one was very obvious from the get-go. He, having just done a fake trip into jumping triangle against Edward Foliang off an overhook against the fence, he was trying to get Cade Ruotolo to come in to, you know, shoot into him on the fence and then use the fence to prop himself up, take the overhook and then jump to a triangle or trip him or judo hip throw him by the whizzer. Unfortunately, Cade Ruotolo wasn't falling for it. Nothing really happened except that there was a cool back take by Cade Ruotolo. It went the full distance. Fair play to Aoki. And Cade Ruotolo tried to buggy choke him from closed guard in the last minute of the fight because he was just like, fuck it, let's do something. So he jumped closed guard and tried to buggy choke him. But it was really interesting because he got the grip and then he tried to release the guard and convince Shinya Aoki to pass to side control, which would then tighten the buggy choke. And Shinya Aoki almost went for it, but they sort of ran out of time before anything progressed. But the Tai Ruotolo versus Gary Turner match was very impressive because Tai Ruotolo harassed him very effectively early on with the head snaps and fake shots and grabbing a leg and so on. And he managed to get him down and pass into north-south almost immediately, which was partly affected by the fact that the takedown happened next to the fence, so there wasn't as much room to move. But Gary Turner, very good guard retention. And Tai Ruotolo and Cade Ruotolo, a lot of what they've been doing, outside passing, as in like toreandos, throw-bys, things like that, things where you're standing and you throw the opponent's legs by or you run around them, haven't tended to work that well in no-gi in recent years. It's much more a pressure, sort of leg pummeling, sort of knee-cutting game. You have to get closer to the guy and you have to keep him on his back. But they're the two guys who are sort of going against that. And what it tends to result in is sort of like 10 minutes of them threatening to run around the guy's guard and then eventually it'll work. So if you watch Tai Ruotolo versus Dante Leon, it's about 10 minutes of boring trying to run around his guard, and then he just cartwheels over him. And it works, because he's been, like, going at him for 10 minutes and he's knackered. Another thing they love to do is, like, run around to almost north-south, grip both ankles, and let the guy try and invert, crunch up and invert onto them. And they'll just sort of hold them there, tiring their abs out. It's a legitimate strategy, it's just not super fun to watch. But he ran past Turner's guard immediately into north-south. Turner sort of started turning into him, and immediately he goes for the dast choke, and both of them are absolute killers with the dast choke. They'll just like grab a wrist and yank it from standing in your guard to dive on a das. Really interesting. The funniest part about this whole thing was, firstly, $50,000 for Tai Ruotolo. Well done. He looked ecstatic about that. But the funniest thing about this is that they show everyone walking into the arena because they need filler, because there's so much fucking time wasting in between these matches. And they're like, oh, here he is arriving at the arena earlier, which they tend to only do for like the main event fighters in the UFC and in boxing. And it's not interesting in either of those. So I don't know why they do it for everyone in one. But they did it with Cade Ruotolo. And he, like, there's double doors open and there's the bus behind him that he's just come off and he's walking through slowly towards the camera. And then they later show Tai Ruotolo. And you know that they were on the same bus. They would have been staying at the same hotel. They had got there at the same time. They're twins. They might even sleep in the same bed. Not in a gay way, just in like a more common wise way. But they would have arrived together. And they made them step off the bus one at a time, slowly walk in, and they went, okay, now you come, Ty. Oh, it's just so cringe. So that was the whole card. It was pretty good, actually. If you haven't watched it, I would say go and watch none of the MMA, probably none of the grappling, maybe Tai Ruotolo's DAS, but watch the five tournament fights, because there was an alternate, But go watch the tournament fights in the 4-ounce Muay Thai because it's absolutely fantastic. The UFC this weekend is trash. Holly Holm versus Ketlin Vieira, no one cares. Santiago Ponzinibbio versus Michelle Pereira is the closest you'll get into an interesting fight there. Chidihan Jokani versus Todorovic, both fun guys, sort of limited, but I'd expect Todorovic to try and take him down in that one. But, you know, Todorovic, fun striking, but quite hittable. Chidihan Jokani, very shit hot striking. Pollyanna Viana, yeah, nothing else on that card matters. Oh, Parker Porter versus Jelton Almeida, that's the memeiest fight I can think of. Love it. And then Jonathan Martinez, you know, not a great record, but I consider him quite a good fighter in that bantamweight division. Well, almost everyone in the bantamweight division is a good fighter, but he's fighting Vince Morales. Just one to keep an eye on because he's quite tricky. But yeah, I reckon that'll do us for today. I'll be back on Monday to talk about the fights that happen. Might do a post-fight breakdown. There might not be a lot on it. I might just make it open for everyone if it's like one fight I want to talk about. But you never know. Sometimes the cards with no names on... Right, I'm your boy Jack Slack. You know where to find all my shit, and I'll see you Monday. Cheers. Buchecha pretending that Shinya Aoki is actually going to submit Cade Ruotolo. Bless.